And welcome back to the Film Reel Cast. As usual, I am Stu, your host. I'm joined by our own Martin Rinks, our own lethal weapon. It's Neil. How are you doing?
Oh, thank you, Stu. That's what a welcome. You can be my Danny Glover anytime, my Murtaugh.
You're just too kind. You're too kind. You really are. Thanks very, very much. How are you, my friend? You good?
I'm very well. All the better for being back with you and talking about an amazing film.
Brilliant. Me too. I mean, Lethal Weapon 3. It's so nice for a change. We've not done this kind of like retrospective series since, I think, possibly The Dark Knight, when we went through each film, which was really, really good. So it's so nice to go through this film, to look at the continuities, to talk about whether it gets better or whether it gets worse. It'd be really interesting to see what your kind of thoughts are.
Definitely. Definitely. It's been a lot of fun watching the Lethal Weapons again. I have to say, it's been many years, and to watch them closely, sort of picking out different bits, it's been good fun.
I mean, when we were doing the Lethal Weapon films, did you have any kind of, I don't know, kind of expectations, or did you think, I'll get to a certain film and then I'll think, I don't know, number two is shit or number three is shit or not really?
I did think they'd probably start to wane like most do, but obviously we'll give our scores and stuff later. But I've been pleasantly surprised with how the series has gone thus far.
So yeah, because they do smash these out pretty quick. I mean, you've got Lethal Weapon in 87, then you've got two in 89, this in 92. It's quite a quick turnaround. So it just goes to show how well this franchise did.
Oh, definitely. They've obviously seen it was hot and they just kept running with it. So clearly they stopped after four for some reason, but we'll review that at some other point.
Yeah, we'll talk about that wise decision. I didn't realise that this was also directed by Richard Donner. Because obviously when you watch these films, you just look at it. You're either back in those days, you put the tape in, play it, and enjoy it, yes or no. But I never realized Donner was still attached to this. And you got Jeffrey Boom as well, because it was Shea Black last time, but he obviously, with the criticism he had last time, especially through number two, has obviously been kicked to the curb.
Yeah, he does the characters now in this, Shane Black, but he's nowhere near the screenplay or the script, which is quite interesting.
It's weird, isn't it? And again, this one had a budget of $35 million. $33 million opening weekend, grossed $144 million in the US, and worldwide $321 million. So you think the third installment, it was huge, done so well.
It's staggering figures, isn't it? $35 million and it's turned into 10 times that. It's just insane. You know, it just goes to show how well received these films were.
That's it. And it goes to show that you get this kind of, I don't know, this the formula, and you get it right. And if it's that good, you can virtually duplicate the same thing again, just with a different storyline, into a third film and still be successful. I mean, I don't know how much comes down to the chemistry of these two or the writing of it. I mean, for me, it's the chemistry all the way.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's definitely the chemistry. You know, those two characters, you don't get many films, do you, where you have the same two people and you love them. You don't want them to be, you know, you want them to catch the bad guys. You love listening to them and seeing how they act with each other and all the silly stuff they do. So, yeah, I definitely think it's that chemistry. Other than the films are good, but yeah, it's definitely the chemistry.
Yeah, 100%. And the kind of the cast in this, obviously, exactly the same. You've got Mel Gibson for Martin Riggs, Danny Glover for Murtaugh. Joe Pesci's in this again as Leo Getz. He's got a bigger part than originally written into this. You've got Renny Russo playing Lorna Cole, Stuart Wilson, who's the nemesis in this, playing Jack Travis, and pretty much everyone else, including the family and like the psychologist as well, exactly the same character.
Yeah.
And I think the film really, really benefits from having the same people in, because you just slot straight into it and it does feel like a third chapter. You feel at home straight away, which is great, because it comes, you benefit from watching number two and number one. And I think you can go into this not knowing what happened in one and two, can't you?
Oh, definitely. It doesn't really refer back to one and two very often. It has a couple of moments where it refers back, But yeah, as a standalone film, you could quite easily stick it on and enjoy it and not think, I don't know what the hell's going on. But it's interesting, isn't it, that Leo gets, excuse me, Joe Pesci originally wasn't written into the script, and it was done afterwards, which I found quite odd, because like you said, he does play quite a large part for a big part of this film.
Yeah, it's a really interesting decision to write him in, to give him a bigger part as well. That's he's kind of like the Jar Jar Binks character of this film. It could have gone either way. Writing him in more, it could have suffered. But for me, as we spoke in the last one, that I really like Joe Pesci as an actor.
And
I didn't realise how many times by accident I actually went to call him Joe Pesci. When I re-listened to the podcast, I thought, fucking hell.
Pesky Joe. Yeah.
Pesky 1, 2, 3. But I'll have to make sure I don't do that. But this will contain plot spoilers. We will talk about this film in detail. And if you haven't seen this, where have you been? But go and watch the film and then come back to these amazing reviews, which they are. So the plot for this is very simple. It's Sergeant Roger Murtagh and his partner, Martin Riggs, arrest Billy Phelps for trying to rob an armored truck. This is just 8 days until Murtagh is scheduled to retire. And we do get that trophy, just 8 days left. One more job, 8 days left. which is possibly where this comes from. Or it works on that formula so well. In the interrogation room, Billy is murdered by ex-lieutenant Jack Edward Travis, a vicious former cop who now sells guns from a stolen evidence facilities. An investigation of Travis and Riggs leads Murtagh to Lorna Cole, who's played by Renny Russo, who's working for Internal Affairs. Leo gets his back, as we said, played by Joe Pesci, is now a legitimate real estate agent. He gets involved when he sees Travis's face on some CCTV and recognises it. And then Travis is pursued by Riggs and Murtagh. And also, I got kind of mixed feelings about Renny Russo, and I'm sure you have as well. Mm-hmm. A shootout is held in the street involving some kids, which has an effect on Roger Murtagh and his family, when it involves Daryl Smithers, who's a best friend of his son Nick, who is gunned down. Guilt-ridden Murtagh tries to drink himself out of guilt, and then he has a chat with a very tropey kind of chat with Riggs, which leads him to chasing down the killer of Daryl to get the guns off the street, which will make him feel better. So that's really the very basic storyline. Again, it's never going to win any Oscars, and it's not exactly really detailed. But the start of this, and this is what I love about these kind of films. I love the action intro that they have. And you kind of, like the James Bond films, where you always look forward to seeing what they're going to do. How's this film going to outdo the next one?
Yeah.
And you get the bomb in like the community centre, I think it is, in the car park underneath, which is over the top by unbelievable measure that Riggs decides that he can defuse it. And that's when you hear Murtagh say, I've only got 8 days left until I retire.
Hey, look, there's no bomb in there. It's probably a false alarm. It happened a million times. Guy probably saw a radio on the back seat.
Hey, let's not mess with this. Wait for the bomb squad.
You're right. You sit tight. I'll be right back.
Hey, Riggs!
What? You're acting strange, man. What's the matter with you?
There's a bomb in that building.
No, there's
a bomb in that building.
There is not.
There is a bomb in that building. Oh. You know how come I know there's a bomb in the building?
How?
Because I got 8 days to retirement, and I will not make a stupid mistake.
Look.
Yeah. It's interesting you said about Bond. They actually open in sequence, where it's all the flames and stuff like that. I automatically said, this is very Bond-esque.
Yeah.
Which was weird. Because the first one was Christmas music. The second one didn't really have an opening. It went straight into a car chase. And then this one's gone, you know, James Bond-esque with the flames and the plinky-plonky music.
It's very stylish kind of opening, isn't it?
Yeah, it goes to, they've obviously tried to, you know, put a bit more finesse to it. But no, you're right. It opens up with Murtagh having 8 days left to retirement, which was the general gist of this film. And why you would do it, that you'd go in and not wait for bomb squad into a car park.
It's mental. You know, isn't
surely
it?
That wouldn't be allowed, but hey, there you go. Only in America.
Exactly. They can go in. And it's funny because it kind of adds to the fun that you know they wouldn't be able to do this. And the fact they've got, you see the car full of Semtex and they're joking about it.
Son of a bitch, just look at it, just look at it.
That's all I'm going to do is look.
My eyes are more plastic than sheer. I love this job.
This is amateur night, Roger.
Open the door, I can't hear you. Open the door. Don't do nothing. Not that one!
And you see, can see how nervous that Murtaugh is and that Riggs just winds him up all the time. And the fact that they're joking is just, I don't know, it's just so unbelievable. It just adds to the fun. It's just nice. And the chemistry straight away between these two is brilliant. It's so funny.
Yeah, the arguments they have over the car, and they're telling each other not to shout because it might set the bomb off. And then the cat lands on the roof and they both shit themselves. And it's just, it's brilliant. And then there's the confusion. He's going, oh, I'm going to cut the blue wire. And he's, why do you know? How do you know about the blue wire? And he goes, well, yeah, it's a guess. I'm going on a hunch. Like a hunch. And then he goes, oh, yeah, that's it. I'll cut the red wire. He goes, hang on a minute. You said a minute ago you cut the red wire. It's just brilliant. It's just, you know, it's fantastic.
Yeah, you're kind of there straight away. And it gets you straight back into it. And you forget, because the chemistry is so good, you forget just how nonsensical the story is that they're actually dealing with at this current time, that that they're allowed to go in just to save time. The bomb squad isn't here yet, that they can go in and just have a little toy with this bomb.
this car full of Semtex, like you say.
Yeah, and it's great tension when they're talking about what wire to cut. And it's just so funny. And as you see that the bomb, they cut the wire, then a clock starts ticking down. And when he says run, and there's a cat that jumps on the roof as well, which scares the crap out of Murtaugh. And that when all the dust settles, literally, all the police officers are standing there just sarcastically clapping both of them.
Yeah, the bomb squad turn up and they just go, they're over there.
Funny. Just the look on everyone's face is like, you two again, you're just fucking useless. Yeah. Absolutely useless.
Idiots.
They get busted down to being patrol officers, and you actually see them for the, I think it's the first time that you see them just in normal kind of like the black or blue, whatever colour it is, the patrol outfits. And it's quite funny because they clearly don't have a clue of what to do or what procedure is, because they're so used to winging it.
But
even when some guy walks up to him and they, well, he's not jaywalking, but Riggs has a go at him for jaywalking, he's got no clue actually what to do.
Hey, hold it right there, pal. Can you step up here, please?
Me?
Yes, you.
Well, what happened?
What did I do? What'd you do? Jaywalking. I saw you. Large as life. I'm going to have to cite you.
Jaywalking? Oh, Jesus, come on.
Hey, can you handle this one yourself? Should I radio for backup?
Smartass.
You people are committing actual crimes in the city, and you're hassling me for crossing the street.
Shut up!
Yeah!
Oh, you know how to fill one of these out?
A long time ago. Let me see.
Yeah.
And it's evident that they're fucking well out their depth.
Oh, no, definitely. It's hilarious, isn't it? He's going, oh, I'm going to have to book you for that jaywalking. And then he gets out the ticket and he goes, you know how to fill one of these in? Yeah. No, he needs a license. He needs his license. Oh, it's just, it's brilliant. But he just goes absolutely mental and starts pointing his gun at this poor bloke that's just walked across the road.
He then tries
to run away back over that same road. And it's just comedy, but again, absolutely nonsensical, isn't it? You never could you pull a gun on someone just to do that, but there you go.
It's hilarious. It's so funny.
Going back to that building that they blew up, that was actually a building. It was the old town hall, and they were going to demolish it anyway. So for the scene, they paid $167,000 for the privilege to actually blow it up. So.
Blimey. Yeah. So that's there like in The Dark Knight, where Joker blew that hospital up, what was pictured to be a hospital, that they actually did it. It's amazing because the practical effects just look so much better, don't they?
No, definitely. I mean, yeah, it's real, isn't it, at the end of the day? So rather than some amazing CGI rubbish.
Yeah, to actually blow something up. It's just like men and fire. It's just great to burn things. To
just
actually
exciting.
Blow something up is so good.
Don't get to do it enough. That's the problem.
Well, maybe we should on the next podcast live. You heard it here first. We are going to blow something up.
Oh, my God.
And these two, you can only describe them as shit magnets, that every time something goes wrong, that they're there. That there's an armored truck heist, which leads to our kind of token gesture sequence. And I forgot to mention the wonderful ponytail. Gibson's still nice. Got his mullet, but now it's obviously in a ponytail. And it leads to a car chase outside this bank. And Gibson, or Riggs, chases the guy, armored truck, jumps in the back, and they have a bit of a fight. And you wouldn't expect anything else. We've seen him running down the road numerous times already. But then you've got the older cop, Myrtle, jumps in. Is this lady? You got Dolores, haven't you? Is she a parking attendant?
No, she's the one in. She's the driver of the armored car. So the one that turns up after, the real armored car that turns up after.
Right.
Her partner gets shot and she takes Murtar and starts driving.
Okay. I didn't know where she came from. She's got the uniform on, but I didn't know what she was. But what are your thoughts on this lady? Because she's really outgoing. She clearly fancies Danny Glover's character.
Oh, I was in fits. Honestly, I thought it was brilliant. It was just so stupid that they're chasing down an armored truck in an armored truck, and she's got spends more time trying to fit him up than actually driving. It's hilarious.
Are you mad? What?
Yes, 24 years. Yeah, 24 years.
Yeah, but it's a worker.
And he's so uncomfortable with it. It's unreal.
Her singing is just mental. She's singing all these songs and she's coming on to him. Yeah. And she's just so kind of flamboyant, over the top. She's crazy. And she fits into this so well. It's the kind of character that written into this is so clever. Because it's just, if you get, someone who's quite loud, times it by 10, put them in a Lethal Weapon film, and they fit in straight away, don't they?
Definitely. But it aimed at what this film ended up sort of being. It was an action film, but it did not take itself seriously at all. There was comedic moments throughout all of it.
Yeah.
A building blowing up, and it's them being stupid over a bomb, and, you know, mentioning Myrtle's bomb under the toilet from the second one. And then, you know, some guy's just been shot, but yet they're driving down the road and she's, even though her mate's just been shot and she doesn't know if he's dead or alive, he's too busy trying to touch up Murtar. It's just hilarious.
And it works so well, doesn't it? As you say, it doesn't take itself serious. And I think if it tried to take itself too serious, it would be just a joke with all the procedures and everything that happens.
Yeah.
It will be just an embarrassment. But yeah, I think thankfully it fits in well with the over the top stunts, the breaking of the police procedures and the way they treat people that without getting any complaints or losing their job or going to prison themselves.
Yeah.
It's just so funny. But it's great when they're cornering and Myrtle's head goes into her lap. it's so funny. She just keeps saying to him, "We've got time later to do that. Just don't do that now." But he's really shaken up because she's quite, well, obviously appears up for it. And he's still that family man. And he's got principles and pride. And even through this chase, that manic as it is, that he's just still so serious and wants to do things like straight down the line, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, definitely. He's just like, keep your eyes on the road, baby. He's like, he even calls her baby just to sort of, you know, chill her out and stuff like that. Because she's going absolutely all over him.
But it's a really good chase as well. Again, we said last week about the practical effects, and they work so well. If it's done really well. I don't think there is any special effects in this.
No, other than the fake glass and stuff like that. I think, it's just a well-organized stunt, isn't it?
Yeah. Go on, mate, go on.
No, I was just saying there's no CGI in it whatsoever. It is just them racing down a road and it's proper.
Could you get Gibson on the front of the armored truck like Indiana Jones in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where he's sliding down the grill with it, and you get all of that and the guy goes through the windscreen, And amazingly, no one gets killed in this chase. Whereas last time it was all about a body count and him dying or shooting people. Mm. That one of the guys in real life, he would be dead, falls off the truck down the motorway. And the other one just goes through the windscreen and he actually does get arrested. And it's just quite surprising because I don't know what the rating of this was, whether they kind of toned it down and included more comedy from Joe Pesci to kind of put it down. I imagine it was a 15, I would have thought.
I thought it would be a 15 again because the, you know, there was still violence and swearing in it. But yeah, it didn't seem as sort of adult as the other ones probably. Yeah, you're right.
No, it wasn't hardcore, was it?
No. But
it goes to Murtaugh's house and Riggs is really already established as part of the family. He's just walking in there. He's even taken his washing into their house now.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that the relationship is really, really good. And they're selling their house. And it's got on the board on the wall, 6 days left until he retires. So it looks like they're going to sell up. And Leo Getz is now, is an estate agent, or is it a realtor, they call it, don't they, in America?
Yeah, realtor. Yeah.
Yeah, that he's selling their house and he's the worst person. There's honesty and there's being far too honest, isn't there?
That's it all.
Very nice.
Oh, I love that picture window.
You do?
It's been completely replaced.
Oh, why was that?
Oh, a drug dealer came through here with his car and crashed right in and shot up the whole place.
Son of a bitch, I'm gonna cut him off.
Leo.
Drug dealer.
It's true. Okay. Anyway, look. You like these drapes? Maybe she'll leave the drapes.
And it's all full disclosure.
Anything else you want to disclose before we go on?
Okay. Now that you mention it, the bathroom upstairs has been completely remodeled due to unexpected bomb damage. Hey, come on, it's okay.
You'll never sell that place.
Oh, it's just hilarious, isn't it? He walks in there and it's just straight off the bat high, isn't it? His voice, his actions, he's just, look at me, everything. And yeah, he walks in and tells them about the fact that that's all been redone because a car went through the window, went through the front of the house, and the bathroom's all been completely redone because of the bomb damage. And you can just see this couple that's come to view the house face just drop, and they're standing there with the mouths wide open. He's like, no, it's fine. Come on. It's fine. See the rest of the house.
Yeah, you've got the whole family in the cupboard really stressed. Now, it's, you'd never, ever, unless you're trying to save a penny and cut corners, you'd never get Leo to sell a piece of paper on your behalf, would you? About a house?
God, no. I suppose they had to write him in somewhere, and this was the easiest way of getting him lots of screen time, because otherwise, where would he have come in? So, but it's well done. But yeah, you're right. You would never, ever in a million years get him to sell you anything or sell anything for you.
Yeah, because clearly, with his track record of laundering money, embezzling money and stuff like that, he'd never get a job as a broker or anything financial, would he?
No way, would he? There's no, yeah. Again, so, only in America.
Well, yeah, only in America, only in the world of a lethal weapon. But
yes.
And you then get introduced to, I love your opinion on this, to Travis. And
yes.
Jack Travis is the baddie in this. And he's with a guy called Tyrone, who's another baddie. He doesn't really play much of a role in it. And we kind of get a demonstration like they do in these films. They kind of put the line in the sand of just how bad that they're going to be. And you get that demonstration when Travis sees the guy who actually fell out of the truck as they were going along the road, the guy who fell out on the motorway. His name's Smitty. And what he does, he kind of basically knocks him out. And, well, he's still conscious, I think, and pushes him in a hole and covers him in cement because they're on a building site, which plays a major part into it later on. And it really shows you just how horrible. I mean, what's your kind of opening thoughts of this guy? A trope or pretty good or not really?
I thought he was a really good bad guy. He sold it. Stuart Wilson played it very, very well. He was just nasty, wasn't he? He looked nasty. He looked sort of, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but he just sort of looked like he didn't give a shit. He'd do anything to anybody, the way he spoke. And he was, how nice he was to that bloke, Smitty, saying, oh, you know, I look after you, don't I? You know, why are you doing stupid shit like this and stuff like that? And he's like, oh, yeah, no, you do. And all of a sudden, he's pushed him into a a pit of cement, you know, and pushing him in there and stuff. And he turns around to the other guy and says, "This is a foundation we can, you know, we can start on, and let's, we can write our names in it and stuff like that." You know, really nasty. But I thought he was quite good. I don't know what you thought.
Now, I thought the same. I thought it was nice to see a normal person just play a normal bad character rather than trying to take over the world or anything that was just too extravagant. It was just a horrible character, and he plays it so well, laughing and joking, and it's really effective when you get the look on Tyrone's face of utter horror, and it must be an awful way to die. Suffocating in cement, of the fact that Travis is just smiling, and that he's so wicked. You really, it's such an easy, simple way, and a scene only lasts about 3 minutes, a simple, easy way of showing just how horrible that this character is. But you don't learn his history, do you? You don't learn that he is an ex-cop.
Not until later, no.
Yeah, from the LAPD. And they kind of, you get the, and this film works really well when you get the serious thing. So you think, oh, fuck. And then it goes to more lighthearted, because you then see Riggs. And again, the more characters are in from previous films of Rhianne, who's now an actress. Remember, she was in the Johnny film last time. Johnny advert.
Yeah.
That she's acting... Well, I don't know what kind of film. It looks like a low-budget porn kind of film, really. But Riggs sees her with a gun against her. It looks like she's being held hostage. So he does what he usually does. Runs along and he saves the day. And the reaction from the director of this is brilliant. It's so over the top. And he gets his just desserts as well, doesn't he?
He does. I have to be honest. I didn't see the point of this scene. It was fun, but I just didn't get it. I was like, why is it in here? It doesn't add anything to the story.
No. I didn't know whether it was because in Lethal Weapon 2 that she was built in to, that he kind of fancied her, but there was obviously never going to happen and there was no payoff. I agree. I don't know why they put this in there, because this film is quite a long film. It's 118 minutes long. This does pad it out and it doesn't add anything. We know Riggs is mental. We know he doesn't give a shit. We know it's the same daughter.
The thing, because the family aren't in this really at all, apart from cameo roles, aren't they? And then to have this, you almost were led in to think, oh, maybe she comes into it later, as you know, like she was in the first where she was kidnapped or whatever. But that doesn't come to pass. And I was sat there going, yeah, it's fun. But by the end, I was like, what? Why? There's no need for that whatsoever. And just because he's poking the director in the eyes, he's not going to just go, yeah, all right, yeah, she can have her job back, that's fine.
Yeah, it is really, really weird film. I completely, really weird scene. And I don't know why they put it in, because we know he's mental.
Yeah, definitely. You know that from the demonstrated, start, don't you?
Yeah, we've had that far worse demonstrated, and we'll get it even worse as we go along, especially into the franchise. But I don't know. It just didn't offer anything really, and it was just padded out. And there is a lot of things in this which are padded out, I have to say, that I didn't really like. From there, they tend to milk just. He looks good. Danny Glover does in this film, and he always looks really, really good. But they're really milking, and I think over the top of he's getting old. He's losing that touch. And it's demonstrated in the locker room and back in the police station. Yeah. They're putting their uniform on when Riggs is... It looks like he's got an automatic gun rather than his six shooter when he shoots into the ground.
Yeah.
And Riggs makes out that it's him banging the lockers and losing his rag because he's known as a bit of a loose cannon. And a few people kind of say that to him when they see him going mental. But he's covering for Murtaugh. He's shot into the ground. And they're kind of like demonstrating that he's lost his touch. I don't know. For me, it was a bit of a sad scene. It was as if whether they were going to think of not doing a fourth one and they were writing them out as just losing it or not. I don't know. I understand why they did it, demonstrate that they're long in the tooth, but I don't know. It just seemed a bit weird for me.
It was a bit, and I agree. You know, we've already got the fact that he said when they were on patrol that he was wearing a girdle and stuff like that, because he's getting a bit portly in his old age, and he's got only a few days to retire. But yeah, I don't. It was almost like writing him down, wasn't it, to say he's not good enough anymore. And you know,
what a sad Mel's scene.
Yeah, it is a sad scene, and it was sad. It didn't seem particularly necessary, but I guess they were trying to write how badly he needed to get out because he was just past it in his own mind.
Yeah, it was just, I don't know, kind of, I think you get behind both of these characters so much because they're such great characters.
Mm.
And when you see them fall, or when you see kind of any imperfections with them, that you don't want to see it. You just want the fun and the laughter to carry on. And this was, out of the blue, quite a downer, quite an early downer on into the film. It's only about 25 minutes into the film.
Yeah.
It's quite a downer, but they quickly go from there, again, like in the first one and in the second one with the foreshadowing, that you get they're on the shooting range and you see this young cop, and I can't remember his name, but they kind of seem to highlight him of a young, good-looking, really keen police officer
who
is just keen as mustard to get involved in everything and know what's going on. And it's, again, it's done kind of overly. They show his target of where he's shooting, of how good he is. And he's really chuffed. And you kind of know a bit later on something either good's going to happen or something bad's going to happen. And being this kind of film, you know it's shit. And they get Murtaugh to take his bulletproof vest off. And again, everyone, and I like it. It goes like hard. Everyone sees he's wearing a girdle.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought Riggs does this to take the piss out of him
definitely. In front
of everyone, didn't he?
Definitely. He's like, oh yeah, you're wearing one, aren't you, as in a vest. And he's like, yeah, I'm wearing it. He only did, and you can see the look on his face, because he's like, oh, I'm having you here, mate, I'm having you over. And it's hilarious, and he's going, I just pulled my back doing weights. Just heavy weights this morning, that's all it is. It's not a girdle. And it's just hilarious. It's
and all the laughter does seem so real, because you've got Riggs putting the bulletproof vest on the target. And behind him, you can see all the other officers laughing and taking a piss out of Murtaugh.
Yeah.
And it just seems so natural and genuine that that's something that they would do. You've got that kind of mentality of the job is so shit. So I can imagine any excuse they have to rip someone a new one that they'll take, and they'll jump on it like a fucking pack of hyenas, you know?
Oh, yeah. I bet it is like that working for the police, though. I bet it's absolutely, once they get together, I bet it's quite fun.
Yeah,
you know, getting a group of them together, I bet they absolutely rip the piss out of each other.
Yeah, this is done so well, it highlights it. And they put the jacket down, and as they put the jacket down, Gibson hands out these bullets that are kind of like red tipped, and he labels them down as cop killers. And I don't know, they've been taken from another bust previously on the streets, haven't they?
It was in the guns of the people that they chased down in the armored cars. So they were in the bullets of the gun that they nicked. So that's how they knew. And that's why they obviously, it leads on, doesn't it, to the next one where they go and get the suspect that they busted for interview.
Right. Okay. I see. That makes sense now. And they even highlight this with regards to the hole in the bulletproof jacket.
Mm.
And I mean, it's going back some way, because obviously these days they use the kind of woven Kevlar, but this one's actually got a plate in. I don't know whether they did have plates in like that, or whether that was just to highlight just how dangerous these bullets are, that they can go through the plates.
No idea. I don't know what it would have been in the 90s. I guess it probably would have been plates back then.
They must have weighed a ton, mustn't they?
No, definitely. You wouldn't want to run around in one of those, wouldn't you? Maybe you could, because you're fit. But...
I don't want to fucking run around in anything, Jesus.
Well, there's a sight for sore eyes. You're running around in nothing. Well, there you go, viewers.
That brings back memories. But it kind of, again, it's another thing that Murtaugh has to worry about. Now he's down to like 5 days until he retires, and that there's people running around with bullets that go through Kevlar. And it's worrying for him, and it's worrying also for the first time. You do see that look on Riggs's face of concern, as if like, well, we are out there and we do go to these things, especially the way that Riggs just reacts and goes to any job going. That if I was him, if I was Murtaugh, I would be shitting myself.
Oh, yeah. Working with a loose cannon like Riggs, you're like, oh, there's no way I'm going to last this long. You know, very much goes back to the first film, doesn't it? Because the first film, they talk about how close he is to, you know, he's only got a few years left and stuff like that. So there's a bit of continuity there.
Yeah, and thankfully this one, they don't play the loony card so much, whereas in number two, and they did play that out on it so many times, of his suicidal tendencies and his like mental health problems that he's got due to his wife. That's not evident at all in this film, is it?
No, he seems really happy, doesn't he? I know he's obviously, you can tell there's, and it comes onto it later, that he's not happy that Murtagh is retiring. And I think he's trying to, I think the underline of it is he's trying to show him how fun the job can be. You know, like he says when they're dealing with the bomb in the car, he's like, aren't you going to miss this when you retire? And stuff like that. So he's trying, it's almost like he's super upbeat to show his mate, look, you know, don't retire. You know, you love this. It's brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. And from there, as you said earlier, they go and talk to Billy Phelps, who was involved in the bank robbery. And then it cuts to Travis, who we saw earlier last at the building site, killing someone, burying them in cement. That he uses his contacts. And that's when you get to learn that he was in the police because he knows where he's going. He knows where all of the CCTV cameras are in the nick. And he goes to see Phelps. And I like the bit where from there, it kind of splits into various people doing various things. It then goes to Riggs and Myrtle in the lift going to see Phelps. That's when you first see Renee Russo, who's got that file on her of Phelps. And they see that it's got Internal Affairs on it, who are kind of obviously investigate other police officers. And just to wind her up, that they start talking about between themselves, kind of, I don't know, embezzling money themselves and defrauding and taking money. I love that scene.
It's Riggs again doing one over on Myrtle, just talking about, oh, you know, you've got only got a few days to retire. You know, I bet that Swiss account, you're looking forward to that Swiss account, you know, oh, the drugs guys, they didn't need the money, you know, and all this. And he's sitting there going, what are you talking about? Kessler Myrtle? What? And you can see Renny Russo just looking back and, what the hell are these guys on about?
Yeah, why should the drug dealers get the money and things like that?
Yeah.
It's so, so funny. And I like the fact that you instantly see that Renny Russo's character isn't easily intimidated. You've got two males, two very kind of like testosterone-driven males in a lift with this female. Usually, she'd be the... It would go to... And I like they didn't do that, that she'd be kind of objectified.
Mm.
And they concentrated on the fact that she was Internal Affairs and not that she was a female. And they didn't kind of put her on this pedestal of the fact that she was quite an attractive woman. And I like that fact, because that would have been really tropey itself. They just concentrated on the Internal Affairs angle
to
wind her up that way. I think it worked well, and it went to show that she can really, really handle herself in these kind of situations.
Oh, no, definitely. She's a very strong character, and I think she played it very well, to be honest. I thought she was very good in it, and I thought it was funny, like you say. There was no sort of, back in those days, it was very sexist, wasn't it, in the sense of, you know, the things they used to say, and the women were very sort of screamy and not hero types, if you like. But she just didn't give a shit, did she? She was brilliant.
No, she handles herself so well, and
yeah.
And she, again, because of her sense of humour, the way, obviously, the writing in this, I think, is really, really good.
Definitely.
And the way it's done is it just feels so natural, and she doesn't feel like a spare wheel. And I think sometimes I was kind of questioning what it would be like if Myrtle retired and it was just both of them. Because they do connect really well, and they're going to see... Phelps, and say they kind of argue the toss, and you do get the kind of trope of Internal Affairs are better than everyone else, and uniform aren't like the uniform police are just nothing. They're just like bottom feeders, and they have to do what everyone says. But then the captain, who does get a much bigger role in this film, agrees that they should work together. And Travis already has killed Phelps, and they go into the interrogation room. Embarrassingly, that right under the nose of internal affairs, they find that Phelps has been shot in the head, and they can't ID the guy at the moment because he appears to know where every single camera is, and you can't see his face on any of them, which I like that. I like the fact that they don't know who he is straight away.
Yeah, it's interesting. They're like, oh, he knew where all the cameras were. And so, yeah, it plays into it quite well how nasty this guy is and how brazen he is that he's just walked into a cop shop and, you know, killed someone.
Yeah.
So you've got to have some balls to do that.
Oh, fucking hell, brass balls, yeah. And I kind of, in a way, I like Joe Pesci's character, but he comes into it after this and he recognises Getz from CCTV and says that he's kind of sorted out some tickets for him and he knows where he's going to be. But it kind of, it bothered me to a certain extent, and I don't know, I'd love to know kind of in hindsight, maybe now he's older, of what Joe Pesci feels about the way it was written and the way he was treated. They seem to really bully Leo, and he's treated like some kind of real idiot, and he's mocked. For me, he's mocked too much, and he's too much of a cartoon character in this.
Oh, he definitely is, but I guess that is just his character, though, isn't it? He was very much the cartoony entertainment from the second one. But yeah, they physically push him around a lot in this, don't they? They really do. They just sort of push him all over the place.
Yeah. And
yeah, because it comes, doesn't it? The CCTV comes from the fact that Internal Affairs had put in cameras in all the interview rooms, but even the chief didn't have a clue that this was actually the case.
Yeah, which I can imagine does happen, I would have thought.
I'd imagine so. Because they said, oh, they're the cops. They're the police, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
She retorts with something funny because they bounce off each other very well, don't they? Riggs and René Russo.
Yeah, and she's very much Martin Riggs, a female version of Martin Riggs, straight down the line to the fighting, which we'll see later on, to her attitude, the way she handles herself, the way she handles other people like suspects. They're just identical. But the ice hockey scene works really well for me. You've got the massive stadium full of people and they know that Travis is there. They don't know exactly where he is. And the fact that Riggs gets on the tannoy and calls him out exactly of what's happening, exactly what he's doing that he's going to get arrested, and just make yourself known.
Mr. Jack Travis. Mr. Jack Travis, this is the LAPD. We know you're in here. We know where you are. Just stay in your seat. Don't be stupid. And I'll be there to collect you and escort you out in a minute. By the way, there's policemen at every exit, so it's no use trying to run. Just stay where you are. Thank you for your cooperation. Play on, boys.
And I do like the fact, and I know last scene that they kind of do recover, that Joe Pesci's character was being just made to look like an idiot. And I felt sorry for him. That he does go hands-on with Travis in the middle of the ice rink, and he does get shot. And I like the fact they give him something to do rather than just be the village idiot.
Wait in the car. No, you can't do... Yeah, no, definitely. It is interesting that they take him along. I suppose because he hadn't actually said exactly where this guy was sitting or anything like that. He just said it was the hockey. But, yeah, he wants to be a cop, doesn't he? He loves the idea of it.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, and he even asks, can I have a gun this time? And it transitions to the whole crowd at the hockey going, no, which I thought was quite well done. But, yeah, no, the fact that he chases him down and tries to tackle him and stuff is quite funny. And it is nice that he, you know, like you say, he was a bit more action-y.
Yeah, and it's kind of slapstick where he's been shot, he's laying on the ice, and he does the old trope of, I'm getting cold, my body's getting cold, and it's just, they bring comedy into this so well, because they could have killed Joe Pesci's character, and to be honest, I wouldn't have minded, but they do bring that kind of, bring you back out of the sadness pretty quick of purely taking the piss out of him, and he is okay.
Yeah, because he goes, mate, you're laying on the ice. That's why you're cold.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, right, okay. And then, you know, they just walk out and go to hospital. And they are bastards to him in the hospital, aren't they?
Oh, they're evil people. Man alive. Not only is he bad enough that he's been shot, but what they do to him is terrible.
They make him stay in hospital for 2 days when he could have been out in a few hours. And they give him a rectal exam as well. It's just unreal. Unreal.
It is, yeah. It's oh, God, yeah, it's terrible. And I'm so glad they didn't actually play that scene out so we saw it, honestly.
Do you know what, though? That's something you do to us, isn't it? You do that. You just go, oh, because that is chart. You'd write something like that.
Oh, it'd be awesome. Yeah. If it was you, it would just, yeah. It would be so, so funny. I can imagine James doing that or Paul or something like that. It'd just definitely. Be... It'll be a great piss take. And then it goes to a scene that is, I know why they do this, and it's kind of America today, but it makes Myrtle look like a complete fool, I think. They go to, they're back on duty, they stop at this burger place, like a street burger place, rather than a restaurant. And Myrtle is talking about, this is the best place, I go and cook the burgers. He's got an apron on, he's cooking the burgers. And behind him, Riggs there, who's always alert, always vigilant, sees, and I forgot to mention it, because obviously it plays into it earlier, of where, in a previous scene, you see outside Myrtle's house, Daryl and Nick. And Nick's obviously Myrtle's son. Daryl is a school friend who's no longer at school, was involved in a gang. And they make that pretty obvious that he's involved in, like, probably drug pushing, gun pushing, and that he's a gangster. He doesn't want his son with him, does he?
Yeah, no, he says, oh, there's some nice gang colours. And, you know, he's like, Nick, be good, sort of thing, as he's walking off. So
yeah, that's it. And they highlight that fact. So it goes back to, and obviously Riggs doesn't know who this person is, really. Goes back to gangs, and he sees some kind of exchange, and you know it's gangs. And Riggs goes to have a look. Myrtle is completely oblivious to what's going on, which I think makes him look like a bit of an idiot, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, he's so fixated on his burger and he's singing about the burger and all sorts that he's, you know, he's not even concentrating on the fact that his mate's walked off. The guy, the burger guy, is just saying nothing at all because I ain't getting involved. It was quite weird. It was another scene where, you're right, it's just made him look inept.
Yeah.
He's been a really hard-ass sort of cop for his entire career, and all of a sudden he's turned into a wet lettuce.
Yeah, and it's strange that his mate, who was doing it in the burger stand, as you say, didn't say to him, look, your colleague's just run off. I think there's something going on.
Yeah.
Which is weird. And Riggs gets smacked on the head with a plank of wood when he tries to intervene. Myrtle comes running out. And then he sees that one of the kids is stuck in this shed, and he fires his machine gun. He's got like an Uzi or something. Mm. Spraying bullets everywhere, and despite the fact that he gives him numerous warnings, this is Myrtle does, that he shoots in and he takes out the kid inside this metal hut, and it turns out that it's Daryl, who's obviously was a close family friend and Nick's previous best friend, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Daryl.
He's dead, and I kind of, I understand why Myrtle was upset, but it was, and is explained by Riggs, it was either them two were going to die or he was going to die. I mean, he didn't have any choice, and I don't know Myrtle's reaction to this, that he's really cut up. It seems really over the top. It really does.
Yeah, no, it does. He didn't want Nick to get involved in gangs and stuff like that, but it didn't play into it about how well they knew this kid. Because you think, you know, he said, oh, is that Daryl? So he obviously knows him, but he doesn't, you know, he's just been shot at with a bloody machine gun. So he was willing to kill the bastard, you know, to kill Myrtle and Riggs. It just seemed over the top. I know he's just killed this lad and it must be horrible, but I don't know, maybe I'd act differently if I was in that situation, but yeah, I think you're right. It's completely over the top.
Yeah, I'm glad you agree with it, because I didn't know whether I was being a bit heartless on that, but yeah, it did seem an exaggeration. But as you say, mate, rightly so, that put in that situation, I don't know how old Daryl was meant to be, whether he was meant to be 15, 16. And I suppose if you do that, yeah, shoot someone that age, it must be absolutely, or anyone, to be honest, horrific. But yeah, to take someone out of that age must be even worse. But it just seemed overacted possibly by Danny Glover on that part, then, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was a message, wasn't it? I suppose, when I don't know particularly on American history and stuff, but maybe sort of gang culture and young people being involved in gangs, and maybe, you know, that ethnicity being involved in gangs was quite poignant at that time, and they just wanted to make a point of the fact that them doing this is getting them killed.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're spot on. I think they're just trying to paint a picture of America at that stage of, yeah, when you had all like the California, Los Angeles, like Bloods, Cribs and everything like that, just coming out, just shooting each other, that possibly, yeah, this is what it's like. But yeah, it just seems strange. But from there, Riggs takes time out. You don't see it, but he's not really in it. And this is when Russo becomes, kind of takes over as his partner. And again, you get the demonstration of how she's not intimidated at all when she follows Riggs into the gentleman's toilet, when they're talking about the gun crime and the kind of the coincidence of there's more and more of these bullets on the streets, more of these guns being sold. And again, she's talking to Riggs whilst he's having a piss, while other people are in there, other guys are in there going for a piss, and she's not intimidated whatsoever. And you can see it building, and I like it. I really like the fact these two, if they did a film where Riggs wasn't, Murtaugh wasn't in it for any particular reason, as long as it wasn't based too lovey-dovey, I think it would work really well with these two.
No, definitely. I think they, like you say, the chemistry with these two is very good as well. So I think it would work if they'd written it originally with these two as partners. It would work quite well.
Yeah. And she, together, they quickly, and I don't know why, obviously they've been investigating this for quite a long time, like internal affairs have. But when they get together, they kind of solve a major part of this crime within about 30 seconds, that they realize that a lot of the guns that are being used were guns that were previously seized by police, by LAPD, and that were going to be destroyed. And I don't know why they didn't work that out kind of quicker. I know it suits the pace of the storyline, and that's what it's all about. But they're going to make some inquiries, and this kind of, I think this is for the benefit of us, just to show how well they get on and how well they're alike, because they go to this kind of abandoned office, and this was straight from the Crocodile Dundee book of terrible things that you could do with animals, which are really unbelievable. You get this massive Rottweiler coming down, Riggs has stopped smoking, he's eating dog biscuits instead, and this dog is going to tear them apart. It's like a wolf. It's huge.
Yeah.
And instead of shooting it, because he says he likes dogs, there he just walks up to it, gets on all fours, and kind of looks the dog in the eye and does like a Crocodile Dundee, and the dog goes all soppy.
That's bollocks.
It's absolute nonsense. It is. Again, this film is a padded out scene that they really didn't need.
No, they didn't need this at all. It's interesting. They cut scenes out of this in relation to other parts, which were more based towards the storyline, then they keep this in. And I wonder if it's just a melism. He wanted in the film to show his different things he could do, you know, and he could be like you say, Crocodile Dundee. But yeah, he's even sticking his tongue out and stuff at the dog, isn't he? It's absolute bollocks. It really is.
And it's annoyingly bad. It's frustratingly bad that. A lot of it you can buy into. You can buy into the fact that he'll go there and he'll try and defuse a bomb, and he'll be on the front of a car and kind of assaulting people and things like that. But doing that with a dog, it was, for me, it was one step too far. And it's, they've done a lot of mental things in this, for the third film, a lot of crazy things. But this was the first time I was annoyed by the stupidity, the levels they went to.
Yeah, I'd rather it, he tried it and it didn't work and they had to run away and find a different way in or something like that. Because doing it that way is just, it was bollocks. I've said it.
Yeah, completely agree. And from there, I don't know if this building's kind of adjacent to where they are already, but you then go into this, like a garage in a way.
Yeah.
And they're loading up these weapons in there. And there's quite a few guys. And Mel Gibson leads the way. He tries to be the man. And he gets captured. Then Renny Russo comes around the corner, pointing their guns. And you think, kind of not knowing the formula to this just yet of what she's like, that they're going to get captured, or she is, and that's going to be like a trigger to what's going to happen. But they kind of point the gun at her and you think she's at it, and then she starts kicking shit out of all of them. I quite like this. I like the fact that they don't put the female role down in as someone who just screams, that she really can handle herself.
Yes, definitely. Ripley-esque is what I say.
Yeah, and she does kick shit out of majority of those guys, and it's really good action. And it's kind of, for this film, obviously it's not believable at all, but in this kind of world that they've got, it's believable choreography and it's quite fast paced and it's just normal fighting, and she handles herself well, and no one, it's not kind of bloody violence, is it?
No, it's quite comedic sort of fighting, isn't it? But it's Jackie Chan-esque, because they're all just, kicking each other and stuff like that. At no point, it's just funny, isn't it? Yeah, all these bad guys have got guns, but at no point do they actually try and shoot them. In the warehouse, they try and take them on.
Yeah, that always makes me laugh. When they're kind of smuggling guns, that no one actually uses a gun. They just try and take them on, even though they've got a gun pointing to their head.
Yeah.
But they do take them out, and they nick a truck full of guns. And more importantly, the dog actually escapes. They stop for the dog.
He does. Now he's his best friend. Now he's made weird faces at him. They're just like brothers now.
And they learn that the truck is full of guns, which possibly are stolen from a police armory that they're going to...
Must be, yeah.
Destroy these guns. And these are the guns that they're going to sell to Tyrone, who is the black guy who was with Travis previously when the guy was covered in cement. And again, it's a kind of, it leads us to what happens next, that Travis says, well, it's not a problem. We'll just go back to our supplier, being another police station, another armory, and we'll just restock on more guns, which is quite a ballsy move. And this leads me to a scene that I didn't like again. I kind of sound like a bit of a hater on this film, but the bit where obviously Gibson has taken a smash to the back of the head when he had that fight. They go back to, you can see it's Renny Russo's house.
Yeah.
And they start, there's that chemistry, and he gets those puppy eyes again, which he had in the previous one. And they kind of start comparing, just like in Jaws, when they're on the orca, comparing injuries, don't they?
Yeah, it's a cringy scene, isn't it? It really is. You know that they're going to do it. As in, they're going to have sex and get it on and everything else like that. But
it is foreplay, isn't it? It's the worst kind of cheesy foreplay, of when Gibson's got his shirt off, he's showing scars, and they're flashing lights on each other, of touching each other's gunshots and shit like that. And it's awful. Again, it's padded out and it's not needed. It really isn't needed in this.
No, I guess it just goes to show how macho they both are. Like, oh, well, I got shot here. Well, I got shot here twice and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
I can understand it, but it wasn't needed, in my opinion.
Yeah, they didn't have the previous scene where she was fighting, where she shows that she's not just a damsel in distress.
Yeah.
Then they could have avoided this scene, but it was just a kind of another layer on the cake of, I am really macho, I do get involved in fights, and look at this. And I'd rather them just go back to their house, talk about how good it was, and then just kiss rather than have this kind of shitty, pointless foreplay. And how quick does Mel Gibson fall in love?
Oh, mate, it's instant, isn't it?
It really is. There was Rika last time in Lethal Weapon 2, that it, first meeting that he fell in love with her and wanted to be with her. This one, it's their first day out properly together, that you can tell he's falling in love with her. I mean, he's got clear emotional problems.
Oh, definitely.
He's, and I'm surprised that he, maybe him and Murtaugh have been together as well. Because
I don't think Murtaugh would go like that myself. But
that's why it's called Lethal Weapon, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
And then Riggs goes to see Murtaugh on his boat. And finally, the boat that we've seen on the drive many times is actually, unbelievably, in water. And he's kind of pissed out of his head. And he must have been on some like a 2 or 3 day bender, still reeling from the fact that he shot some kid who was, again, going to shoot him. And he's kind of milked this fact so dry now, I think.
Oh, definitely. And this is what I mean about the scene that was deleted. It was put back into the director's cut. But his Murtaugh's wife comes to see Riggs at his sort of thing he has on the beach.
Yeah.
To say, look, he hasn't been home in a few days. Can you go and see if he's all right? And then that quite happily leads to him going off to the boat and everything. And then this scene.
But instead, oh, really?
Yeah, but it's in the director's cut, apparently. But, yeah, they deleted it from the theatrical version. But then had other scenes in it, which were, you know, with the bloody dog, which were completely unnecessary.
Yeah, because I didn't know that. Because I obviously watched, like, I'm sure you did, the theatrical cut.
Yes, yeah.
So I wonder how long the director's cut must be, then.
I don't know. I don't know how long it is, actually. I don't even know where you'd be able to see it.
No, this is just short of 2 hours long. Mm. It's padded out a hell of a lot. So and it's weird that they've cut out relevant scenes that would have kind of been helpful and put in scenes of him with a dog and other just shitty scenes with Leo Getz as well. It's really bizarre. I don't know. I'd love to know if this is driven by Mel Gibson, who was, again, still at a pinnacle of his career, making some really cracking films, of how much, say, of airtime that he had.
I think it probably is. That's, you know, like I say, with the dog thing, most people would watch that and go, that is awful. We're not putting that in the film. You cut that and you'd add that to the director's cut or whatever. But I think that's more him, like you say, trying to be the comedy actor.
Yeah. Yeah, completely agree. I mean, so Riggs goes to see Murtaugh on his boat, as we say, and that you learn he's cut up because of what he'd done. And we know that already because that's been explained. And that's the reason why Murtaugh isn't out on duty with Riggs. And thankfully, they do save this scene, I think, personally, of a comical element of when Riggs is dying to tell him he's in love. And this is when you find, as I said earlier, that he falls in love so easy, that he's in love with someone. And the fact that Riggs believes, Murtaugh believes it's Rhianne, his daughter, so punches him in the face, which is really nice. It breaks the ice completely, and that's when he learns it's Lorna from Internal Affairs. And I think if they didn't have this scene, it would have suffered so much more. I think this saves the scene with, they just pull out that comedy element, don't they?
Yeah, again, it's him, he's shot this kid, he's clearly completely lost it. And it comes back to them and his thing around his daughter, isn't it? You know, the fact they're very flirty and stuff. So no, I think it saves him. It's good to see that it pushes him out of that mood because he comes back, doesn't he?
Yeah. And I don't know what this is kind of building themselves up for with when he's talking about being selfish and he doesn't understand what he's been through.
You kill a lot of people. You kill a fucking lot of people. You ever kill a baby? You got ice in your veins. You ever kill a boy like Nick?
You selfish bastard! You selfish bastard! You're just thinking about yourself. God damn it. What about me? Huh? We're partners. What happens to you happens to me. After all the shit we've been through, don't you get it?
And it's not really setting us up for anything in the film. And you know what, if you've watched number one, if you've watched number two, you already know what Riggs has been through with regards to his wife.
Yeah.
and losing Rika as well. And we know what Murtaugh's been through. So I don't know why he says in this film that you've no idea what I've been through and everything, because there is no payoff for this. It's not leading to anything. We've already introduced to his family. We already know their history. And I don't, it's meant to be a powerful scene, but there is no payoff and it doesn't lead towards anything.
No, you're right. Like you said, from the first two films, we've learned everything about them, haven't we? There's nothing else. Yeah, I know he shot a child, all right, a teenager who's a gang member, and that is, it is sad. Any child dying is sad. But he's a cop.
Yeah, and his family would understand that. And it's weird because it goes from that scene, which is meant to be the powerful scene, but for me, especially being a dad, that where he's with his son on the day of the funeral when he's helping his son Nick shave, to me, that's a more powerful scene that it kind of goes to show the bond that he has with his son, how close they are compared to obviously the relationship that Daryl possibly didn't have with his dad.
Yeah.
And that what he was missing out on. And for me, this is, even though there's less said in this scene, just visually it's a more powerful scene than him being drunk on a boat. And I think this works really well, of basically being the same kid who's been in all of both films as well. I think that helps, you know?
Oh, no, definitely. The fact that they don't change the cast in this, and like you say, you've come to really get to know all of them. And I know the family plays less and less parts as the series went on.
Yeah.
You still are attached to it.
Yeah.
Because you've had those comedic moments and those moments where something's happening. So it is a touching scene. And for something that's really comedic in a lot of ways, it does go to show just the simple thing of a dad showing him his child, you know, his teenage son, how to shave. You know, and some people don't get that.
Yeah.
Do they? And it just shows the importance, doesn't it?
Oh, it's a really nice scene.
Yeah. Just going back to the boat very quickly. Yeah. Apparently, his boat's called Code 7, which is actually the LAPD code for lunch break.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there's a little fun trivia fact for you.
Oh, okay. I didn't even know that. So from there, they go to the funeral scene. What do you make of this funeral scene?
Now, I don't know, even though I'd known the family and you want to pay respects, if I could have gone to that funeral having known I'd put that one in him in the ground.
Yeah.
If you see my point. But again, I think this plays on the whole gang issue and stuff like that, because he obviously goes up to say his condolences and he gets slapped in the face, which is fair enough. Even though you've got all the gang members there as well. And the dad's quite poignant, isn't he? And he turns around and he says, just get the guy, find out who's put the gun in my son's hand.
You want to do something, Sergeant Murtaugh? You find the man that put the gun in my son's hand.
Yeah.
So I think it is, like most of these, it's like the second one with the apartheid and everything, there's always something behind it. They always have a message.
It's, as you said, I think you were spot on earlier when you said that this is the current state of what America may have been like back then. With regards to gun crime. And it was, for this film, it was something that it was a plot driver to get Murtaugh back on track, into as part of the team.
Yeah.
And giving him a focus and something to do, especially as the clock's ticking, that he's going to retire.
Yeah.
That he's only got so many, probably, I don't know, 4 days by now, 3 days to actually do this before the clock, or before he retires, really.
Yeah.
So that's probably the reason why he did it. And from there, they then go and see, or one by one, they go and track down different people and they go to Tyrone's house. And they easily find him. I don't quite know how they find him so easy and they take him down so easy. But interestingly, that Riggs takes the Uzi, obviously, that Daryl had, that he had on him when he shot him. So he's clearly gone into evidence, taken evidence, a machine gun out with him and he's using it whilst he's on duty. I'm sure there's a couple of rules that he may have broken there.
Oh, it's just standard procedure, isn't it? You know, you've got it, you just take what you want, do what you want with it, it's fine.
It isn't the world of lethal weapons.
Semi-automatic machine gun, and I'm taking about 5 clips. Is that all right? Yeah, crack on, mate. It's fine.
Yeah. I'm sure property won't miss that whatsoever. No. But they you kind of get another demonstration. The three of them then go out. They're clearly in love now. Their relationship is blossoming with Renny Russo and Mel Gibson. And they go to this garage, and again you get more goons, and again you get another fight scene. But this time, he wants to demonstrate just how effective, just how mental and alike she is, that she goes on and she takes on these guys. And again, it works for me because it's unbelievable, over the top, and it's done with an element of comedy. And it's really good fighting, good choreography with Renny Russo and these guys.
No, definitely. And it's just quite funny, isn't it? Because he's like, have you got a warrant? And he's like, no. She goes, no. He goes, well, then fuck off. And then she just kicks the shit out of them all. And it is brilliant.
But, it's right to the point, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. She's like, he's like, fuck off. So, she just headbutts him. It's like, I'll show you what to, you know. And a few of them are on top of her and stuff like that. And it is brilliant. It's like you say, very well choreographed. And yeah. Mel's just in the rigs, I should say. He's just in the back going, go on, honey, you can do it.
Again, it's over the top, unbelievable, complete nonsense. But it's great. And the look on Murtaugh's face of, oh, my God, I've got another person just like Riggs here, female version.
Yeah, because you've got Murtaugh looking like that. And then you've got Riggs basically just looking at how he's basically just saying, oh, God, I love this woman.
The payoff is brilliant. It's so funny. Yeah. And obviously they do get them. And from there, you get Captain Murphy, who gets his part to play, leaving the police station. And that's when a lot more of the dots are kind of connected, that Travis is waiting outside. And it always makes me laugh. Outside in front of a police station, there's been loads of police officers. And the way he kind of meets him, he's leant over the captain's car as if he's some kind of drunk. And the captain walks up to him and says, what's wrong? Can I help you? And he turns around and puts a gun in his belly. And there's all of these police officers around.
Oh, no, it's weird, isn't it? It's like it's the most inept police station ever. It's like, oh, some drunk bloke across a cop car. Ah, it's all right. It's fine. Leave it.
It's amazing nonsense, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is. I wonder, I'd like to have seen, because in the last scene, or the last film rather, all of their department got murdered and wiped out.
Mm.
So it would have been interesting to see how they re-employed everyone to get that, kind of get the roles in their department, because I mean, you can join and work with us. Last time, everyone got murdered, but feel free to work with us. And they don't, unlike last time, they don't really bring the rest of the team into this.
No, not at all, no. No. There's a couple of scenes, isn't there, like when he gets him to try and do that back kick, and Murtaugh is clearly useless and kicks over a water fountain, which is just basically Riggs mugging Murtaugh off.
You get the psychiatrist come up again.
Yeah.
And they mock her, which is, I feel so sorry for her, because all she wants to do is have a moment of glory and actually help. All they do is just take the piss out of her.
Oh, no, definitely. It is hilarious. But no, I guess you know, this is very much gone back to them again, hasn't it? Rather than the team, it's all about.
Sergeant Murtaugh. You could be experiencing some transitional anger here caused by the shooting. You want to talk about it?
I think he's okay for a change, huh?
Are you sure?
You know, you really look good in it. That's your color, I think.
I've got a little extra time now, Sergeant.
These two, and then obviously Russo, that's obviously involved in it as well. But this is when we get reintroduced to Dolores.
Yeah.
Don't we? She's the lovely Dolores.
And she comes out of that line, the jam, the jelly roll or something, doesn't she?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, she's just hilarious. She brings in flowers and everything else like that.
Hey, Steady! Dolores, you remember me?
Yeah,
I remember you.
Listen, can you tell me where I can find the lovely Sergeant Murdoch?
Well, as a matter of fact, Dolores, he's cowering down on all fours right behind this counter.
Listen, where's the sergeant? I want to see him.
Well, he's not here at the moment, Dolores, but, hey, you know, he's talked to nothing but you all week.
Shut my mouth.
Hey, the man's on fire.
What's the matter, baby?
Oh, a little sciatica. Oh,
you tell him Dolores was here. You tell that man that he's the jam in my jelly roll. I'll see you, baby, okay? Bye-bye.
And thankfully, she takes it as a joke. You know, he will sell him out at any point for a joke.
Oh, God,
it's
yeah.
Brilliant. It's fantastic.
I'm glad she wasn't in it anymore, though. You know, yes. I think if they would have started to take her on bloody missions as well, it would have been...
Oh, yeah, no, it would have been far too much, wouldn't it? But it was just funny that, you know, it wasn't just left there, so to speak. It was,
it was done just right. And you see Travis with Captain Murphy breaking into the armory. And as they're doing that, again, you've got Myrtle Riggs and Lorna trying to work out what the connection is. And then they do work out that the guns are from the police armory, and the armory just happens to be downstairs. And it just happens to be an escape hatch onto a subway, which is only protected by a normal door into a police station.
I know. I mean, that's security right there.
Right. So the contrived convenience of this is absolutely amazing, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It's funny how they figure out what they're doing just as they're taking the guns.
Yeah, they're building a subway under the police station, and you can just through one door, you can get from a public subway into a police station.
Into their vault, pretty much, by the looks of it, you know. And they just can wheel things in and out like there's, you know, clearly no one looks after these automatic weapons and everything else. They're just left there.
It's nonsense. But they do get down there, and it is too late. And Travis has taken Captain Murphy with him. And again, this leads to the foreshadow which we had earlier, where that young, keen cop is taken with him. And it's just his first day, and he's not really seen any action before. And he's such a promising kind of police officer, student, probationer, that you know there's only one way this is going to go. And it does. You get the shootout in the underground, in the subway, and they use those bullets and they shoot through like an oil drum, and he gets killed pretty much straight away, which is, again, meant to be, if we need any more motivation for why these guys should be taken down, it's this young officer being murdered, isn't it?
Yeah, it's that heartbreak thing, isn't it? Now,
did it work for you?
No, it was so obvious it was going to happen. Like you just said, the foreshadow from earlier, they've had this lovely scene with him in the shooting range and how powerly they are and everything. And then all of a sudden he's going, I want to come to sort out these guns. Like you said, there was only one way it was going to work. He was going to get shot. But I guess in every film so far, Riggs has lost someone.
Yeah.
It's usually been the love of his life or, you know, and I suppose this was that person for Riggs.
Yeah, exactly. You need to lose someone who's innocent, who's done nothing wrong, who's got so much to live for. And this kid ticks this box all the time. And if Renée Russo would have been less of a known actress, because I think at this time she was probably doing like the Thomas Crown Affair and she was really well known.
Yeah. But
possibly she could have bitten the bullet at the end. And I think the film would have really suffered if another female would have been killed. And I like the fact that they keep her as such a strong character, because it would have been too tropey and I think kind of too disrespectful in a way of having this woman of just being objectified as in, oh, she can't do anything because she's a female and she needs two men to rescue her. And I'm glad they don't do that. And I think that that kind of helps the film. But again, I don't need some kid dying. Being injured, yeah, fine. But he doesn't need to die, because we know how bad these people are already. I don't need him dying to prove it.
Well, he's already, you know, suffocated someone in wet cement and stuff, you know. I completely agree. It was obviously going to happen, but it didn't need to. And you've already had a teenager get shot by the cop because of these guns and stuff like that. Like I say, it's just that heartbreak thing that Mel or Riggs rather, needs someone to die in these films to spur him on even more.
Yeah, it's like Murtaugh had the rage when Daryl died.
Yeah,
Riggs gets the rage when this kid dies, which leads to another running scene down a subway tunnel where he's chasing a truck, which is just like Octopussy, where you get that old German kind of Mercedes on tracks.
Yeah.
Where there's other cars on tracks, but Mel Gibson does run, and it's like a bit like Die Hard kind of esque scene where he catches his car up, and it's just way over the top, and it's not needed. Again, this is so padded out, this scene. I expected them to shoot the tyres on their own car so it could fit on tracks as well. I'm really surprised they didn't do that.
Yeah, it was tropey, wasn't it? And the fact that he jumps on the front of the train to chase it down and all this sort of stuff. And he's got his badge out saying, no, it's LAPD, go faster, go faster. I don't think anywhere in the world that a train driver would speed up their train if some crazy lunatic had jumped on the front of it and showed some badge that you probably couldn't see properly through the windscreen with a fucking gun. It's utter bollocks.
Well, not the way that our guys go on strike every 5 minutes, and if someone does a shit wrong, that they'll be on strike. Yeah. So the fact that he was on the front of their train, it's nonsense. I like the fact that the car goes off the tracks and then he pulls a lever and wheels come down and then it turns into a normal truck. That's pretty cool. The convenience of when Mel Gibson comes out of the train station, there's an officer there on a motorbike. That he then jumps on the motorbike. And you get this. It's quite a good chase. It's not bad by any means. You can tell it's obviously not Mel Gibson. And I love the stuntman wigs they use. And I always wonder whether when they rewatch these for continuities, whether they kind of think, that's proper dodgy wig. That doesn't look anything like it, you know.
You get quite a lot of those in these films, though, don't you? It's like when you've got Arnie's doubles and stuff like that in films. You know, they just cannot look the same, and I think they just try the best they can. But it's nice that they, again, obviously the technology wasn't there, but all this now would be CGI, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I'd rather we have the odd wig malfunction and keep it as it is, as you say, mate. Yeah, you're spot on. It's much more enjoyable, much more believable, and it is great. It's because when you see them driving down like the freeway against the oncoming traffic and all the cars moving left and right, and when you think the planning, the organisation that has to go into each of those cars doing the right thing at the right time to make the scene work, is really impressive, I think.
Oh, massively. I mean, like you say earlier with the choreography and stuff, it's insane how much effort is put into this film. With all these things, because one person doing one thing wrong in this and it's all fucked, you know, they'd have to do it all again and set it all up, and it cost them days and fortunes in redoing everything.
And all of these people, especially when, like in the old days, that when you watch these films and when you kind of see like Spartacus and Ben-Hur with thousands and hundreds of people, and that each one of them has got to be paid, each extra. And why these films cost so many millions to make.
Yeah.
It's absolutely incredible. And this chase scene, I really enjoy. It's kind of Matrix, like the second Matrix-esque with regards to like the freeway and the driving. And they get to a stage where you get the classic bridge that isn't finished yet.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many of them is in America. It seems to be every film that you get these. And the truck ends up turning around and they have a game of chicken. And Gibson slides off and his bike, and it looks really good. It kind of goes off the edge of the bridge, and Danny Glover is below it in his car, kind of wondering where he is. And then Mel Gibson falls about 40 foot off this bridge, who's previously hanging onto a rope, through these massive sheets of wood. And you get that scene exactly from the last one where he puts his shoulder out, doesn't he?
Yeah, I don't know why. One, you'd never survive that, would you?
You'd broken neck, legs, various things.
And the fact that I think it's just playing on the fact that, you know, he's so double-R'd, isn't he, that he can come out of this with just a dislocated shoulder. He pops it back in and he's absolutely fine.
Yeah, definitely. And again, it's the motivation of that he's really angry now. Now they've got away from him, and now he's injured. And it's exactly the same as the last one, where he goes, now I'm pissed, now I'm going to get him. And it's kind of, it's good. It's got that, if people like the Lethal Weapon films for these reasons, they go back to the, exactly the same formula that works. And I know we watched this for a critical eye, but you kind of, I don't need it.
No.
I can tell it by just watching it, just how he feels. But Leo works out when it, because Leo turns up every single time with valuable information. And again, they mock him, tells him that he's found out where he is, and that they're at a kind of a construction site. And he knows that, and it's kind of like a big housing project that they're building. And looking on, I don't know how true this is, but looking on the notes on IMDb, that apparently this was an actual housing estate that was left because they went bankrupt.
Yeah, apparently so. Yeah, which is quite interesting, isn't it? The fact that normally they'd have to build that whole set, but yeah, I guess they just bought it and said, well, we'll knock it all down for you.
Yeah, and what they did was they covered the wood, apart from a couple of, I think it was something like 24, 26 houses, something like that. And apart from two of them, they covered all of them in this kind of protective coating that the wood wouldn't burn. It would catch fire, but it wouldn't actually damage the wood.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah, and they put lots of gas canisters down to create the kind of extra effect that the wood's on fire. And when they burnt everything afterwards, it wasn't actually damaged because of what they actually put on the wood, which is really, really clever.
That's a great idea.
Just saying they would never fucking do in this country. They just smash it all up and think, fuck it, we'll just spend the money.
Well, generally, we wouldn't build our houses out of wood, though.
Well, yeah, they do in America, don't they?
They do, yeah. We have old, different way of doing it.
They go to the climax of the film now, where Murtaugh and Riggs go to this housing estate, and you think that, and I like the fact that she's involved, but you think that Renny Russo's character isn't going to be involved, but Coles does turn up, and they've got guns and everything, and you see that Travis is there, that they know who Travis is now, and they need some kind of decoy. And in, as in the last film, when they had that house on stilts where Rick says, look for my signal, you'll know it, he does the same thing. And that, conveniently, they are wooden houses. In this country, it wouldn't work because all the houses are built out of bricks and like mortar, so it wouldn't work. But they get a car and they set it on, they punch like the petrol out of it, and he drives through the all of the wooden houses, putting his kind of fuel everywhere as a decoy, and they cause this massive fire, don't they?
Yeah.
Oh, first of all, they put their car down the high street, don't they?
Yeah, they send it just through, don't they, and drive, and then all these bad guys come out of all the woodwork and start absolutely, filling it with bullets.
It's really satisfying seeing a car get the shit blown out of it, isn't it?
It's going back to blowing stuff up, though, isn't it? There's nothing more satisfying than blowing stuff up.
It is. It's great. You're seeing a car going down the middle of the road and everyone just shooting at it and they're tearing it apart. It's so good. I always wonder, do they kind of have specialists around with proper bullets and they're all shooting this car? Because it looks really realistic that the car is being shredded.
Maybe they did on this. I don't know. That would be interesting to find out, actually, because, normally you'd think it'd just be special effects. But how do they put all those holes in it?
Yeah.
So maybe it is done that way.
Yeah. I'd love to know how they do that, because it's obviously got to be choreographed really under strict conditions if you're shooting at this car. But it is completely shredded at the end of it.
Yeah.
And I know that, like Die Hard, where they do stand up and they spray their machine gun kind of in a distance of about 20-foot radius. But in this, it's a bit different when they're shooting the car, and they do get pinned down. That's why Mel Gibson does create a distraction of driving this kind of this truck through all of the houses, putting fuel everywhere, and it does catch on fire. And it's visually, it's a really effective scene, especially as this is set at night and you've got all of the houses ablaze and all of the guys are pinned down. And again, Renny Russo does join in. She does give as good as she gets, doesn't she?
Well, she's the one that kicks it off, isn't she? She jumps out. They're all sat before he drives the vehicle through. They're all talking about, we go on through and all this sort of nonsense as they normally do, and she just pops out and goes, nope, I'm having this one.
Yeah.
And she starts getting shot at. So it just goes to show, you know, how many balls she's got.
She does have balls, doesn't she? Definitely.
Oh, definitely.
And I didn't like what ruined it for me. When you look at these films, you do invest yourself in these films because they are so entertaining, that obviously Riggs being, and I'd love to know how it worked out, that if they kind of at the end of it, they said, well, Riggs has got to go after Travis. And why can't Murtaugh go after him? I honestly don't know. But Riggs goes after Travis. And bearing in mind that, yeah, Gary Busey's character there in number one. And when he was fighting kind of the South African guy who was competent at kickboxing in the second one.
Yeah.
But Travis gets the upper hand on Riggs, which effectively is really unbelievable compared to the people he's fought against.
Yeah, is it? Oh, yeah, you could play on the fact that he had his injured shoulder, but there again, he had those in the other one. So, or the fact that he was so enraged because he shoots Renny Russo, doesn't he?
Yeah.
First, and then he gets the drop on him by getting the rope round his neck and stuff like that. But yeah, it is weird how this old retired or kicked out cop, who's a nasty bastard, don't get me wrong, but he's able to get one over on him.
Yeah, and it's an exciting scene. I like the way it's playing out, that kind of Gibson, you think his time's up, and they're still surrounded in this house, which is on fire, and that Travis is driving this digger with the big forks down, pointing at him, and you think he's not going to die. Obviously, he can't die, but it does build that tension. And conveniently, Murtaugh is close enough to throw a gun containing the cop killer bullets. And the way he sprays the bullets through the front of this digger and takes out Travis is really good. It's really effective. It's not over the top, I don't think, because you know these bullets can shoot through like metal. So it's not a surprise. And visually, it's pleasing. And he just drives the digger with kind of a dying Travis into this burning house. And conveniently, they all get out. But it's a good ending. And you, even though Renny Russo has been shot, thankfully she's got a bulletproof vest on, and that they're not cop killer bullets. Otherwise, she would have been out. And yeah, she's still in it. And it's a really good ending. It's not over the top. And for once, it's more believable than Gary Busey fight and the South African fight as well.
It is and it isn't. I mean, I like this scene because Murtaugh actually comes into his own for once. He throws and he finds those cop killer bullets, and this guy gets the drop on him, and he actually does something action-y for once, and he, you know, throws an axe into his chest, which is unusual for him. And then obviously, you know, he throws the bullets over to the gun over to Mel.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about the axe. I mean,
yeah.
When did Murtaugh become an expert at throwing an axe?
It's true. When did he? But it's nice for him at some point in this film not to be the wet lettuce. Because all throughout this, it's him. I'm going to retire. I've shot my gun off by mistake. You know, I'm in a drunken mess. And all of a sudden, because he's like the cop from years ago, if you like, and someone gets the drop on a gun, he uses his intuition and throws the axe in his chest. Unbelievably so, don't get me wrong. And then, you know, I think it's just quite interesting. I don't think if you knew that you knocked someone down to the floor, I don't know how you would react, but I don't think I'd climb into a really slow digger and drive it towards him at about 2 miles an hour.
No. It's quite funny, isn't it, that you do that, and it's like that death in Austin Powers when he's going to run him over with the steamroller.
Yeah.
That it takes ages for him to get to him.
It's a fish called Wanda, isn't it, if you can remember that. Yeah, it really is. And it's just like, oh, come on. I liked it, and I liked the way they did it, and obviously so they could use the cop killers against him and that, and I thought it was clever, but it was, it was completely tropey.
Oh yeah, the setup is—it's almost as if when he's in that digger, when he's going towards him, and you've seen that Murtaugh's got those bullets, that you want to shout out and say, look, he's got those bullets. Throw the gun to Riggs. And he hears yeah. your voice and does it. And you think, thank God for that. It is convenience. It really is.
It really is. It really
is. Like if he would have been allergic to peanuts, that Murtaugh would have found a bag of peanuts on the building site. And he would have thrown them to Riggs. He would have thrown the nut dust over Travis.
Yeah, and he's like, no, my allergies.
Yeah, it's so convenient. And as I say, from there, I like the way it goes kind of full circle, because the next scene is Murtaugh in the bath, just like Lethal Weapon 1 started, when it's his birthday, but he's kind of like retiring. It's retirement cake.
Yeah.
And then he decides not to retire. And I kind of wonder if they had Lethal Weapon 4 set up for this already, you know?
I think they were. At the start of this, they probably were like, oh, no, we're not going to write, you know, this will be the last one. But maybe they did secretly think, no, we'll do another one.
Because this was 19... what was it? Lethal Weapon 3 was 1992.
Yeah,
Lethal Weapon 4 was 1998.
Wow, long, big gap.
Yeah, so it is a massive gap. And I wonder just how they kind of, if they did have this on the horizon, whether they did have a possible script. Because I know Lethal Weapon 4, again, is Richard Donner. And Shane Black is back. I don't know who else is back for it. But I know Shane Black is back as one of the writers for Lethal Weapon 4, which I can't wait to talk about that. I know James will be there when we talk about that as well. Because that film, wow, it's very interesting. There's a hell of a lot to say. But whether what we'll come up with, the conclusion, the score we'll give it, is due to Shane Black, I suspect it is. But yeah, so it does end with that he's not going to sell his house and that he's not going to retire. And it sets it up nicely for another film, which for me at that time was really pleasing, which is what I wanted. They could have done another film the next year and I would have been like invested into watching it.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's just interesting, isn't it, how it took so long to do a fourth.
Because
you'd think it was after 6 years, the interest in Lethal Weapon would have sort of waned slightly. But maybe we'll find out that when we review it another time, how that went. But
yeah. So your best bits and worst bits and your score out of 10, would you recommend this? Let me know your thoughts.
I definitely recommend it. It is certainly more slapstick than the other two, though the other two have comedy elements in it. This is really driven by the comedy side of it. Best bits and worst bits, I think worst bit is them comparing scars. Oh, no, sorry. The worst bit's the dog. The worst bit's the dog scene. Completely didn't need that in it whatsoever. It was horrendous. And I think the best bit for me is just the amount of times that Riggs throws Murtaugh under the bus. There's so many comedy moments, like with the girdle and other things like that, and with Dolores and stuff. And it's just their chemistry. Even though this is the third installment, the chemistry's as strong as it has been from the start. So I think they're my worst and best bits. And I'd probably give it a strong 7 out of 10.
Wow. That's good. I mean, would you recommend this to anyone if they've never seen the film before?
Oh, definitely. I think it's definitely worth watching. Like I say, as a standalone film, it's good if you like a comedy action film. But if you like, you know, if you enjoy the series, you have to watch the third one. I definitely recommend it.
Yeah.
What about you?
I don't think I've got any like standout moments in this that the bits I really, really enjoy. The worst bits, I agree that the dog is terrible, and the extra bits, like the bits with Rianne, was padded in. They didn't need that. And also the kind of the drivers in this, like Daryl getting shot and on the boat as well, where he's pissed up, they weren't needed, or they could have been done in such a different way that that would have been, like, the viewer would have been more invested in it, would have had a lot more payoff. I think it suffers from that. But the best bits, I kind of struggle because it is just enjoyable. Yeah. There's so many parts in this. If I was just passing it again, like I said last time, that if it was on in like a window of a shop, that, or if I was just flicking through the channels, I'd stop because I know that the action comes thick and fast in this.
Definitely.
So it would make you stop and watch it, which is always a good sign for any kind of film. I'd give it a 7 because it's just entertaining. It's not great. The first one was so impactive. It was so original. And again, they're feeding off the same formula and they're getting away with it. But is this the last time they do get away with it that we'll talk about next week? And I'm sure we'll all come up with the same opinions and it'd be interesting to scores. At the moment, I'd go in the order of the films of how much I enjoy them at the moment. What about you?
I'd have to say so. Yeah, I think it was close between 1 and 2. And this has got worse, but it's still very good. But yeah, I'd definitely say 1, 2, then 3 as a different end. But when I watched 2, I sat there after and thought I really, really enjoyed that one. But no, 1, 2, and 3 as it goes.
Yeah, definitely. So that was Lethal Weapon 3. Next week, we will be doing Lethal Weapon 4 and we will be joined by James as well, I hope. So have his valuable insight into a film which I already know what I'm going to score it. I've already watched it.
I'm going to be interested in this.
Yeah. So, but in between then, we do have our YouTube channel and I've just finished all of season 3 of Cobra Kai. So we've got 1, 2, and 3 and The Mandalorian and The Shield. I'm going to put another review up, a short review of a film I've just seen called 365 Days. Which is a Polish film currently shown on Netflix. And it was recommended by my friend April. And it is a terrible film. And she does owe me minutes back in my life. So at the weekend, I'll be putting a review up of that film. And that will just be a very short one. But there's loads of non-spoiler reviews. There's another one I did called I Care A Lot. Which, again, is quite controversial. Again, it's on Netflix. So just go up on the playlist. Of various films and it's on there. So there's so much. And again, our back catalogue of our audio podcast, we've got so many films. And thanks to everyone, last month, we had over 24,000 downloads, which was amazing, isn't it?
Oh, it's fantastic. I can't believe it. So thank you everyone that listens to us talk absolute nonsense. We thoroughly enjoy it and we're pleased that you do too.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. I just echo that completely. So we will be back next week. We will be back with Lethal Weapon 4. And thanks to everyone listening. I hope you enjoyed this. I'm Stuart and you're lovely, Neil. And we are the Film Realcast. And we'll be back next week.
Goodbye.